Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's do a podcast. Yeah. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Sunday, September 10th, 2017. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on iTunes and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now on Twitter at Chris Lamberth. This is episode 237. I have a super special guest, the very lovely and talented, the intriguing Ashley Brooke Roberts, New York City actor and comedian. I had a great fucking time talking to her. This might be it's up there with one of the best episodes I've ever done. I would say that, dude. It's one of the best ones. I'm going to pat myself on the back. I'm going to metaphorically pat Ashley Brooke Roberts on the back, because it was good. I had a great time talking to her. And I'm going to share that conversation with you in a bit. It's Sunday. It's football Sunday. It's the first week one of football. How about those Patriots losing to the Chiefs? I didn't know that was going to happen. I don't know if anybody really did. I thought that was just going to be a cakewalk for the Patriots. Like, it was just so, like, the pomp and circumstance. Obviously, they won the Super Bowl, but it was just like, it was America. Like, it was just like the Patriots. It was just on some make America great again type shit. And it was just like, ugh. And I fell asleep during most of it. But when I woke up, I was like 42-27 Chiefs. I was like, damn. Okay. All right. And then there's a picture of Tom Brady like pouting on the bench, being all mad. And somebody photoshopped a tiki torch. And it was just so funny, man. It's just, the internet, man. Come on, man. God, it was so funny. So I am not going to boycott. I'm just going to have, like, I've been saying this for weeks. I'm not going to boycott because of Kaepernick. The NFL, it's been a part of my life for my whole life. I think everybody should understand right now. I think I had this conversation with Randolph Terrence, where we were talking about just basically the emperor has no clothes, and we know what it is. And Lebatard said this stuff all the time, that we've been complicit with this game. We know about the CTE effects. We know about the hypocrisy of the NFL, how they, we know all of this, and yet we still watch. But props to the people that are boycotting. I do not cast shame. I don't look down on you. I don't have any negative response to people boycotting. But I'm gonna watch, and like I've been doing for the past 10 years, I've been falling asleep on it. But if there's something coming up that they're like, Chris, do you want to do this thing? It's on a Sunday during the football season. I'll be like, yeah. Do you want to do this artistic thing that'll further you in your career, or make you progress as an artist? I most like 95% of the time I'm going to say yes. So it goes. NFL's here. I'm excited. Not excited as I used to be, but I'm excited nonetheless. I got some chicken wings from the grocery store this morning. But what I am going to do is cook some broccoli too. I'm going to have some vegetables going on. I'm not just going to be some asshole about the food. You know what I mean? I'm just not going to eat like an asshole. So this week was pretty good. It was busy. It was a short week because of the holiday and all that. So that was good. I had an audition for a commercial. That was pretty neat. I downloaded NBA 2K18, The Prelude. They're starting to make all these sports games to be like RPGs now. You got to jump through all these hoops just to get a scrimmage on, just to start playing. And like, they make that more important than the actual playing of the game. It is pretty fun. You have this character, but it's always like some plight that a character has to go through. Like I was looking at that, the Madden long shot where this guy, like, he quit football because something happened, and then he joined the military, and then something happened, and now he's got his last chance to play in the NFL. He's on this fucking American Idol style TV show. Then with this one, it's like, oh, you think you're just going to create this player? He's a young guy, and you know, like, they're like, oh, you quit basketball to become a DJ. And so the guy's name is DJ, and it's just like his nickname is DJ. And then, like, all this shit happens, and he's trying to get an agent, and his friend is like this Asian girl, and there's not a problem. I don't have a problem with that. But his friend's an Asian girl that kind of acts black. And I was just kind of like, dude, how do Asian people feel about that? Like, there's kind of like, should I side-eye that? I mean, or should, I don't know. It was just kind of like, it's a little bit too much, you know? I don't know. But it's fun. It's better than 2K. It's better than Live. Somebody wrote this, like, conspiracy. They probably did write something, but they put up a YouTube video about why everybody's saying NBA Live 18 is better than 2K18. And they're just talking about, like, how EA Sports, like, invited all these 2K YouTubers to, like, they kind of wined and dined them and then let them play the video game or gave them some copies and blah, blah, blah. It's not going to be, they got a long way to go before they get better than 2K, or if that happens. I don't know that that's going to happen. What's cool about 2K18, this demo, is the fact that you do this little prelude thing, and when you buy the game, I guess you upload that player to your 2K, whatever the fuck. But after that, you can play. You can do a scrimmage between, you play as Golden State and you scrimmage against the Cavs, and it's basically like this tutorial, and it's pretty cool because it shows you how to do all the moves, even though those moves to me still are like Street Fighter moves, you know, whatever. But it's fun. It just looks better. The feel of the game, it feels a lot better. Like, it just feels like the movement of the players. It feels like you are controlling that. Like, it feels like the animations that come from those movements and the way that you move the controller and all that stuff. So I just think it's an all around better game. A couple more things before we get to Ashley. Oh, I wanted to say, so last week I was talking about Insecure. I guess that was kind of a bonusy type episode, even though, like, you got the indie movie corner for Ingrid Goes West, and I just threw out an hour of me blabbing on episode 236. I was talking about Insecure, and Ashley and I talk about it a little bit. She hasn't seen the show, but I forgot to mention the fact that Little Rel's character on Insecure, how he was going to make a play at Molly. He definitely laid the groundwork because he gave her that Garrett's popcorn. That's Chicago, like a Chicago, like a staple in Chicago, that popcorn. And I tweeted that, and I tweeted this, guys. that he definitely did that. And Garrett Popcorn, they favorited my tweet. I definitely think I don't even know if he has a character name. He's just like guest star Little Rel. No, I don't even know, and I'm not gonna look it up right now because it's. But you know what? You know it's Little Rel, and he's definitely gonna make a play at Molly. Hashtag. I guess what? Nice guy hive. Like that. If I was a character on Insecure, I would probably be Little Rel's character, or I would be Daniel, because I think Daniel did. He was like the MVP of like two episodes ago, like maybe like episode six or something, when he said, "Yo, you know, you." He told Lawrence, "He's like, yo, you fucking up, man. You went and hooked up with this girl and you moped around." He basically told Lawrence about himself, and Lawrence was like, "Oh shit, I do. I am kind of that dude." So. If I was a character, I would probably be, yeah, Daniel or Little Rel. Yeah. So look, guys, and stuff I'm watching. I didn't go to the movies this week. I'll probably try to see It this week. Maybe go to the AMC because they got the $5 Tuesdays if you're a Stubbs member. And I got a $5 coupon, young. You know what I'm saying? So I might make that happen. I know all you nerds are talking about it. So in order for me to be in the conversation, I'll probably see it because that's the only thing that's kind of popping. Like, well, actually, Mother comes out next this week. So I'm definitely excited about that. But I hope it's not this limited release bullshit to where you're not going to be able to see it unless you live in New York or L.A. And granted, I could, cross state lines easily and go see it, but that's kind of a chore. Anyway, let's get to Ashley. Ashley Brooke Roberts is a comedian that I met a few years ago. Very funny, talented lady. She hosts a weekly show at UCB East called Fresh Out, which I've mentioned a bunch of times on this show. Just a really, really funny comic. And we got to talking because during my residency on that show last month, we were just kind of chatting, in between sets and whatnot, or after the show, and we were just talking about like North Carolina, and then we just started rattling stuff off, and we had a great time talking, and she was just very open about her life and what her struggles were, what her joys were, and it was just some really cool, and she's led a really interesting life, and then we got to talking after the show, and we were talking about some place like Danville, Virginia, and I think Martinsville, and I actually called my mother and let her speak to my mom, and they talked a little bit, so that was pretty neat. What else can I say? I mentioned my James Baldwin I Am Not Your Negro story. What I didn't tell, I don't think what I relayed to Ashley was the fact that my favorite theater, Jacob Burns Film Center in Pleasantville, New York, I saw that movie with a bunch of white people, and I was the only black person there, and I think there was like an Asian guy in the theater, and I was saying how I've said it, all this year, basically, like a movie like I'm Not Your Negro, and to a lesser extent, Get Out was not necessarily a movie for black. It was kind of like for white people to look at this and be like, yo, am I like this? Or what can I do to change? Blah, blah, blah. And I don't think I fully relayed encompassed the entire thing that I wanted to with just looking back. But that just gives you a pretext for when we go into the James Baldwin stuff. Also, and we mentioned the Ta-Nehisi Coates piece, the essay, The First White President, which is an excerpt from his upcoming book. And that's really good. Like, I reading that, like, I was just like looking at every, there's a lot of words that I was like, I kind of know what that is, but I'm looking it up anyway to just make sure that it's what I thought it meant. And yeah, like it's just like they should rap Genius his shit, because people were talking about, you would have thought a Kendrick Lamar album just dropped and the people share that thing just like an MC just dropped something or an artist just dropped a new project. So like it's really good. It's a good read. It makes me want to read more of his stuff. I've read pretty much all of his Atlantic things, but yeah, it was great. And we mentioned that in our conversation. So just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with the very lovely, talented, and delightful Ashley Brooke Roberts.
I was just going to say that I relate because I have an aunt who I did not speak to. I mean, I would see her at like family functions, sure, and stuff. Yeah. And I definitely like her. She's great. But we've never been like the type to talk on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And she has just gotten like super into politics, you know, since Trump was elected. And so like we talk on the phone now. So
yeah,
it is an interesting dynamic when, you know, people change. Everyone's always changing. And
yes,
so talking about family members coming in and out of your lives in significant and unsignificant ways.
It's a constant evolution, I think, just being a person.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't like the fact that you, like, it's like, okay, it's great that you love Jesus and you found yourself and you found a new, like, thing in your life. But it's like, don't judge me. Like, don't think that you're better than me because you just found this.
Right.
And he was going back and forth with me on Facebook on, like, Messenger.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, look, he's like, hey, what kind of Bible do you have?
No.
What kind of Bible do you, because it's our daily bread. And I was like, look, man, I had a lot of Bibles because I studied the Bible since like elementary school through undergrad.
Mm.
So it's like, I've kind of taken a break.
Yeah.
I've taken a break and I've took the lessons from it to be a decent person and try to, you know, live my life right.
Yeah.
I hope it does the same for you.
That's, wow.
And he didn't write anything back.
He didn't write anything back.
No.
I'm so envious of people who studied the Bible in their youth, mainly because I feel like just, you were a theater major, mm-hmm. right? So I was an English major, and like everything is some biblical metaphor.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
In modern literature.
Sure.
And so people in my class would just be like, oh, yeah, this mirrors the story of XYZ. And I would have no, you know, I didn't have that database to reference.
Mm-hmm.
But it is seems to be the foundation for most of like Western literature.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Because it's sort of like, I don't know if you could say it's indoctrinated or it's just like it's a part of socialization, definitely, mm-hmm. from mine, because God, like, I was talking to my parents yesterday on the, like, driving home from work, and we were talking about religion and stuff, and we were just like, I told my dad, I was like, when I was a kid, I wanted to be baptized, and he just baptized me over the sink, and I was like, no, for real, and then him and my mom came up, like, primitive Baptist.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I was just...
Oh, really?
Have we talked about this?
No, we did not. No.
Oh, my God. That's wild.
Yeah.
My family, like, not my mom, but if you go back two generations, they were primitive Baptists.
Okay.
Yeah. God, that is such a very niche and forgotten part of baptism. I've never actually met someone in New York who knew also what primitive baptism was.
Yeah, and then, you know, we've talked the last couple of weeks about just you being from North Carolina, and mm-hmm. it's sort of like, that's where my family's from, and it's sort of like, it's not necessarily surprising to me that you didn't go, so you weren't religious growing up at all?
No. So my
even
parents,
in the South, just
I know. My parents both, they were very young and mm-hmm. they were very rebellious.
Okay.
And they started you know, long, long, long history of mm-hmm. religion in my family. Like you know, my great 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 grandmother and grandfather donated a ton of land to Pleasant Grove Church, and so that was sort of our family's church, and lots of people who were diehard Baptists, Southern okay. Baptists, Primitive Baptists. My grandmother on my dad's side actually sort of kind of broke the mold and became a Methodist, and her family was upset about that. And there's some Quakerism that she was the first rebellious one. She went like a little Methodist, a little Quaker. And then when my parents were so young, and they started bringing me to a church, and one day there was a sermon about gender roles, and my mom was just like, fuck no, we're not doing this to Ashley. I don't want her to be crippled by, you know, baptism, Southern baptism, in the way that I was. Can I cuss on this podcast?
You just do whatever the fuck you want.
Hell yeah. Yeah. So they were like, no, we're not going to raise her under that. So then there was just like no religion at all, which my grandparents were kind of like, okay.
Yeah. And where'd you grow up in North Carolina?
So the formative years, the formative years were in Chapel Hill. I moved there when I was 13.
Okay.
And then prior to that, it was a couple of coastal towns. So there was Wilmington. I spent a lot of time in Wilmington in elementary school.
Did I tell you that I went to the Dawson's Creek?
Did I
say that on stage?
You said that on stage.
God, that's that had to be what, 17 years ago?
Wow.
Jesus Christ. It's beautiful down there.
It's gorgeous.
How did you deal, you and your family deal with the hurricanes and stuff?
Oh yeah, we had a lot of hurricanes. Yeah. So that was like a part of life, I feel like, in Wilmington. So I was there from like the first couple of months arriving on this planet to
we do a lot of segues and there's different like passageways that we go down. Before we started, when we were mic checking, you said, where were you, how your mom went in labor?
I said that she went in labor. I was just talking off the top of my head.
Sure.
She went in labor in a flea market when she was 19.
Uh-huh.
And then my 14-year-old uncle, who was her brother at the time, put her in the back of his pickup truck and they drove to the hospital. So I'm a little flea market baby.
I love flea markets, though. Like North Carolina, that's the only, I got to say, that's probably the only time I've been to a flea market was in North Carolina.
They're great.
Yeah.
They're so great.
When I was a kid, it was one in Eden, North Carolina.
Mm.
Have you been there?
I haven't, but you just saying that got me so excited because that is such a off the map, town area in North Carolina that it is. I know that flea market must be incredible.
It was.
Yeah.
For me, it was just like the football cards and stuff like that.
Right.
Because when I was a kid, I love football cards. And that would have to be every time we would go visit my grandparents, my mom's parents, I'd have to go to the flea market.
So I actually sell vintage clothes online. It's like a little side business
that
I don't really talk about yet.
Okay.
It's not that I don't talk about it.
I'm gonna kind of do an Instagram story.
Yeah.
I just want to be cool.
It's called Hello Handsome on Instagram.
Okay.
And I don't talk about it in comedy really, but it's not that I don't mind talking about it, but I sell vintage clothes online. So like these are all the vintage clothes behind me, and I go to North Carolina to get my clothes.
Okay.
It's like it takes hours and so much traveling.
But, Jesus Christ,
Chris. It's okay. It's okay.
I hate that. But it's part of the story. I'm still learning.
It's just treasures.
Yeah.
Absolute treasures.
Is it like your Etsy thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's on Instagram and there's an Etsy store.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay. What's the website?
It's called Hello Handsome.
Okay.
And comics get 20% off.
All right.
With the code HELLOABR.
All right. Well, so I'll put that in the notes and everything.
Oh, great.
And all
I've never
that good
talked
stuff.
About it on a podcast before.
Oh, see, this
very
is
exciting.
There we go. I think when I was down there for my family reunion on my mother's side, we stayed in Eden, and we stayed at Howard Johnson's.
That makes sense. Oh yeah, that's a chain. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So we stayed
a Hojo.
There. Yeah, Hojo.
Yeah.
And there was a Bojangles next door.
I love Bojangles.
So let me ask you this, being a Southern girl.
Yeah.
Bojangles or Chick-fil-A?
Oh, Bojangles.
Okay.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
I mean, Chick-fil-A is great.
Yeah.
Chick-fil-A is great, but they're not open on Sundays. So that's a big mark off. and, you know, Bojangles, that's a good question. I don't know, because I always thought of Chick-fil-A as healthy.
Yeah.
And Bojangles as like, you know, fast food. Bojangles is probably my favorite of all time.
Would you put that over Popeyes?
Oh, hell yeah.
Because, see, I don't know how much Popeyes that people have down south. I know it's like, especially in that region.
Right. No Popeyes there. This is moving to New York was the first time I had Popeyes.
And okay.
I do love Popeyes. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Popeyes is great. Popeyes is the better KFC.
All right.
And I love KFC. KFC in New York, though, is not good.
KFC. See, Black Twitter is not a fan of KFC.
Okay, tell me why.
When I was a kid, it's fine.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't, Popeyes was just, I don't know, just Popeyes.
Popeyes. Well, they have the Louisiana sort of Cajun thing going on with the spices, which I love, because you do not get that at KFC.
Right.
But you do get that at Bojangles. So that's why I feel like Bojangles and Popeyes, they feel like a little bit more in competition, mm-hmm. I guess, even though I but because my favorite thing at Bojangles is the Cajun filet biscuit, which Popeyes should have. I feel like they, if they want to, you know, kick it up a notch.
Is that just like the biscuit itself, or is it just like the chicken biscuit?
The chicken biscuit, but it's the Cajun filet chicken.
Oh, shit.
It's so good.
Now, see, I had Chick-fil-A this morning. They just opened up one in Teterboro, New Jersey, like where the, by the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really good, but they don't have the spicy chicken biscuit.
Mm.
When I was down there, I got the biscuit.
Now, and it's good. So what did you have this morning?
Just like two little chicken biscuits.
Gotcha.
That's good.
I'm a big fan of the chicken sandwich.
Okay.
Chick-fil-A, because it has those little pickles it comes with, and I love that. And I love their waffle fries. Always been a big fan of Chick-fil-A's waffle fries. Wait, but why doesn't Black Twitter like KFC? Is it because of the food, or is it like politics I'm unaware of?
That's such a nice, earnest question. I don't know, but sometimes Black Twitter shits on stuff, and there's really no explanation. But Popeyes is universally the number one chicken.
Oh.
Now, I lived in Chicago for 5 years, and I was introduced to Harold's Chicken. Now, somebody like Clark Jones and Will Miles could attest to the greatness of Harold's. I think that's probably like all around best fried chicken I've had, like store bought.
Gotcha.
But Popeyes, just on a national level, I would say is probably the best. But then I was introduced to Zaxby's.
Never had Zaxby's.
See, Zaxby's, I think, is further south. Like, Zaxby's, like, South Carolina.
Gotcha. I don't mean to interrupt, but I am shocked, because I feel like Bojangles chicken is so much better than Popeyes.
See, I haven't been exposed that much. They just, like, within the last 10 years, they opened up Bojangles in Maryland.
Okay.
So there's a little more exposure. I think when my parents get chicken, I guess most of the time they go to Popeyes.
Really? I wonder if it's because it's like a sense memory.
Maybe.
Because like I grew up on Bojangles.
Yeah.
And like, so it's like the first, you know, chicken biscuit you have is always going to be the best.
Yeah.
Right?
Of
and
course.
So now in the Popeyes juxtaposition, I'm like an adult. I've been there. I've done that.
Yeah.
But, okay. Well, this is good information to have.
It's interesting, though, because it's just, because you tap into something that I can relate to, just especially the childhood thing, where I love burgers, and to me, Fuddruckers has that. I have that childhood nostalgia attached to it, because I would go there with my dad all the time, and after going to the batting cages,
sounds like heaven.
Yeah, I was never going to be good at baseball.
I know, that sounds like a fun day, though.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, we would go to Fuddruckers. How did we get on that? We were just talking about chicken and
childhood memories
and Eden, North Carolina.
What about, I'm going to throw this one out,
okay.
Golden Corral.
That I don't have that much exposure to, but I know that it's a thing.
Because when I think of childhood like foods, I think of Golden Corral's like yeast rolls. They have like yeast rolls with like a whipped honey butter.
Oh, shit.
That's so good.
What I can tell you, though, K&W Cafe.
I love okay, K&W see? Cafeteria. All right, shit, all right. I love yeah, yeah. K&W Cafeteria. They have great fried chicken.
It's been so long since I've been there.
Yeah.
But my aunt used to take us there, and that was good. What the hell is the there's a fish place in Greensboro. It's like cat.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Me and my boyfriend got in this like long discussion about this.
Is he from North Carolina?
No, he's from New Jersey. And there's like a similar chain that also has Captain in the name, and it's like Captain John's or Silver John's or
Long John Silver's.
Long John Silver's. Not that. Okay, no. It's but there is a Captain one that is
Captain D's.
Captain D's. So good.
Captain D's. That used to be so Carolina Circle Mall. In Greensboro, we used to go to the movies there, and then my aunt liked to go to Captain D's, and we would get McDonald's. But there was like this, I don't know how much of a chain it is. I think it's just a fish place, but it's really good.
Captain D's, I've seen a few of them, mm-hmm. but I think it's a small, like very small chain.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love that. Because they also give you like little vinegar packets mm-hmm. to put on your fried fish, which I don't know if they do that. I don't know if that's a Southern thing or not. Maybe not.
I think maybe it's a fish thing.
Maybe it's just a fish thing.
Yeah. Like what you said. Maybe it's just a fish thing. So you grew up in mainly Wilmington area, mm-hmm. Chapel Hill and all that?
Wilmington area. So for most elementary school and then middle school, there was like a year where I lived on this island with my mom called Oak Island.
Okay.
Which is like right on the North Carolina, South Carolina border. And we were the only people who lived there because it was like a rental island. Like people would only come there in the summer. And so we lived there in the fall and the spring.
What was that like?
It was awful. It was really, really bad. Why
was it just like, why was it awful?
I will say that, okay, so I went to a different school. Oh, I also lived in Roanoke, Virginia for a bit. So I went Roanoke to a different a school. You've been to Roanoke?
Through it, but not enough time to, but yeah.
I went to a different school pretty much from second grade to ninth grade.
Why?
So we moved around a lot. Parents, young,
okay.
There's changes in jobs, they divorced, yeah. Okay. You know, just like a lot of moving around. And Oak Island was the worst, and I'll hate it forever, because the people were, it was like very, very, very redneck, like mm-hmm. super redneck. And I had come from Wilmington where I was going to like a Montessori school, which, you know, I
speak on the Montessori school life a little bit, because I don't think I've ever talked to anybody from a school like that.
Heaven. So I went to Montessori school on and off.
What does that mean? Is it like the learn at your own pace type
yes.
thing? Okay.
It is a learn at your own pace type thing, which is a little, which does mean that I entered public school and I did not know my multiplication tables.
But you had a good sense of self.
I had a great sense of self. And I had a pleasure for, you know, seeking out things I enjoy. So like when I went to fifth grade in a public school, I constantly got in trouble because I would sneak out and just sit in the bathroom and read, yeah. You know, and they'd be like, you've been gone for an hour. And I'm like, this is my reading time. Like I wasn't used to like structured classes. I didn't know multiplication. I didn't know cursive.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to second grade, that was in Roanoke, and I didn't know how to read. And they were like, how is this child not know how to read?
Really?
I knew how to kind of read, but not on a second grade level.
Is it just the school system, or is it just like you were probably stressed the fuck out, probably?
I think that it was a combination of like the Montessori school is definitely like a learn at your own pace. Mm-hmm. So I was doing so much art. I was like doing so many plays. I painted a yeah. painting that was like the school's emblem for like a decade.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, Montessori schools do require parents to be very active in gotcha. the at-home learning. And I think my parents were just kind of like, they were just young and, you know, they were just kind of like, she's going to absorb it. You know, look, she's got all this energy and she can talk to it. And I was just so vocal with adults and I was so unafraid of social situations that I think that made people think that I was a little bit more advanced educationally than I was.
So what did your parents do for a living?
So my dad is a mechanical engineer.
Okay.
So he started at, he worked at a nuclear, reactor site for CPNL, in Wilmington when I was very young. And then then we moved to Roanoke and he worked for an architectural firm. And then he moved to Chapel Hill and he worked for UNC Hospitals for years. So he worked for UNC Hospitals and then he was in Greensboro for a while working for Moses Cone. And that's the hospital in UNC Greensboro, And then he was at Greenville for a little bit working for them. And now he's in Charlotte. He works for the Charlotte Memorial Hospital. Okay. So that's how I ended up in Chapel Hill, because I went to live with him when I was 13. My parents got divorced when I was 7. So I went to live with my dad in 8th grade. My mom, she was a stay-at-home mom while they were married. And then when they got divorced, she was a secretary for many, many years. And then she's always been like a little bit of an entrepreneur. So she had her own cleaning business where she cleaned houses and apartments in Wilmington for a while. She was a massage therapist. She did that for a long time. And now she's a respiratory therapist at the Durham Veterans Hospital.
Okay.
So that's my mom.
That's cool.
Yeah. And that's my dad. I feel like I want to say one thing about Oak Island.
Yeah.
I want to go back to that.
Yeah.
So many fleas. Okay. They don't tell you this. If you live on an island, sand fleas are everywhere.
What do you do to protect yourself?
It was impossible. So we just constantly were having to bomb the house with flea bombs. And it was just like living with sand fleas 24/7.
I haven't even heard of sand fleas before.
Yeah, I hadn't either. And they were everywhere. And that was like another reason why I hated Oak Island.
Did you have brothers and sisters? Or?
No. So I've been an only child my whole life until recently I got a brother.
How did that happen?
So my dad, he is engaged to, I call her my stepmom because they've been dating forever and they're practically married. They're engaged. They've been engaged for like 5 years. Her name's Rachel. She's great. A wonderful addition to the family. And so that's a fun thing about having very young parents is that they can have a kid when they're teenagers and then they can have another one when they're, you know.
How old are they now?
So my dad is, he's like 52.
Oh, that's young.
Yeah. And my mom's around the same age. So give or take 2 years, if I think about it, let me think about it.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So my dad's 55 and my mom's 53.
Oh, they're pretty young.
Yeah. And Rachel's a few years younger than my dad, but not too many. And then she got pregnant when she was like 47.
Wow.
So she thought,
holy shit,
she was going through menopause. I know. She was like, she had, you know, had like a situation where some drugs interacted with her birth control. Uh-huh. And then she started feeling weird and she's like, I must be starting menopause. And because she's like 46, 47. And then she had my little brother, Porter. So he's like a little accident that we cherish.
Is he okay? Is he cool?
Yeah, he's so
like
cool.
Healthy and shit. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good.
Yes, he's all very healthy. Yeah, because they were kind of like, they had all those tests done.
Yeah.
There's like very invasive tests you can have done in like the second trimester and stuff to make sure that there's not going to be any sort of issues. And yeah, he's totally cool.
Well, that's great. That's good. Yeah,
he's really cool.
So now but most of your life you've been an only child.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm an only child. Yeah.
Oh, so
I was an accident.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
My parents were, I think my dad was my age now, 37. My mom was like 35, 36, something like that. Yeah.
Did they get married?
They're married. Yeah. They're 49 years.
Wow. That's wonderful.
Well. On paper it is.
Yeah.
The family reunion that we went to last year was at the church that they got married at. That was pretty neat. It's like they love each other. It's like they love each other, they're codependent, but it's like it's a thing like maybe they could have split up. But it's just like, I don't know, maybe they didn't believe in divorce. I think on both sides of my family, my parents are the only ones that stayed together.
Wow.
And then
that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. The other, my her one of her younger brothers was married before, and he remarried. He's still with the woman he remarried, but yeah, everybody else is pretty much divorced.
And how old were they when they got married?
So my dad now is, he's like 70. They got married in 68. So my dad was born, he's born in 1941. So if you say 1968, 27.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so cool to have old parents.
I love them to death.
Yeah.
I think they're great.
And by old parents, I mean people over 30.
I know. Yeah, yeah, no, I know. Like, it's you kind of think, like, people were, I don't know if you watch Insecure, the HBO show.
I need to, because you know Julia Johns?
Yes.
She's like obsessed with it, and she keeps like literally texting me every day, "Have you started yet? Have you started yet?"
She did the artwork for my Week at the Creek.
Oh, cool.
It's a show like again, Black Twitter. Like it's a show that people, like, they become obsessed with it. But then it's become a thing where people get really sensitive about it.
Mm.
And I'm thinking it's partly, 'cause I talked about this last week. I think it's partly because they can really see themselves in it, where it's like these people are in their early 30s and it's kind of grounded in reality. It's not that it's funny, but it's just kind of like, it's fucking real in a lot of ways.
Is it like situationally funny and not like joke funny?
Yeah, it's not jokes. It's just kind of like, someone said on a show, the shout out to the Firestarter podcast, they said it's kind of like in the same vein as Girls.
Okay.
Where it's like there's the sex, there's this the relationships that people have with each other. It's very grounded in reality, and I think a lot of people are seeing themselves in these characters.
The best form of art.
And they don't like what they see.
Oh.
And there's stuff that's like happened to them, but it's just a show. Like, 'cause it's easy to like kind of watch a show like Game of Thrones, which I don't watch, but there's dragons and there's all this stuff, there's incest and this crazy stuff that's going on, right? So I've heard. And it's kind of easy to detach a little bit.
Right.
But this one is kind of locked in, and I think maybe because, God, I'm thinking like when my dad was my age now, he had a house, he had a wife, he did shit, you know, like, you know, and there is a bit of like, ooh, maybe like arrested development, but I think a lot of people are kind of seeing themselves in it. Then there's the whole gender wars thing that goes on. So
I can't even, okay, I cannot wait to watch this show.
Mm-hmm.
I only watch MTV reality shows.
Really?
So I need to add a scripted show.
Yeah.
But what you just said about like where our parents, like if I was where my mom was, I would have a 14-year-old daughter.
Shit.
Which is insane.
That's crazy.
Insane to think of.
And there's some of my classmates, like, they have kids.
Yeah.
But I noticed that it just seems like generationally, it's just kind of like, I mean, like I was out of the house at 18, but I was in college, mm-hmm, and then I was an hour and a half away.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I got my freedom. Mom, can you do my laundry?
Right, right, right.
You know
right.
what I mean? So when I was 22, I moved to Chicago, and I was away.
Right.
But, yeah, I haven't been home since I was 18. But then there's a lot of people that are just kind of like, I don't know, like they're kind of floating out there. I don't know.
When you say you haven't been home since you were 18, you mean like
live there. Right. Live there. Like,
gotcha.
Yeah, I'm not like, I'm leaving you, Mom and Dad. No.
Yeah, I'll never see you
again. Yeah, I'll never see you
like,
again.
That's a long time to visit.
Yeah, I was talking to them about that. Like, we were talking about like leaving, like my dad was talking about leaving North Carolina. We were talking about like family shit.
Mm-hmm.
And then cousins, like, it's not to really, I think it's just a progression of what, I don't know, maybe you have this in your family. You have like family members that just kind of stayed home, like they just, and they're still there. And regardless of how, what their station in life is, that's the decision that they made. So in some ways, I'm not trying to say like, I'm the black sheep, but in a way I am. Like a lot of my cousins, some of them didn't go to school. Some went to school. They're doing their thing. some just stayed in Virginia and Maryland and North Carolina. They didn't like venture out there. Do you
I cannot relate to this more. Okay. Yeah, I think my biggest accomplishment is getting out of North Carolina. I found it to be incredibly difficult out and stay out.
Oh, shit. Speak on it.
Well, it's just like speaking to what you were saying, which is like all of my family members for the most part live within, 10 minutes of each mm-hmm. other, and they have for generations. And there is sort of, there's so many factors that go into that. I think most of them are socioeconomic. Like, I think maybe I was the first one that was sort of exposed to this idea of, you can go. And I think before me, it was all about surviving, because mm-hmm. this is like
sure.
both like very, farm families. So yes. Both farm families, both my dad's family was a little bit higher class wise than my mom's, in the sense that like they owned like a little convenience store and like they had like a little restaurant for a time period. And so there was that factor. Oh, and my grandmother, my dad's mom, was like the first person in our family to go to college. And then my mom was the first person in her family to go to college. So it was sort of like, and me and her are the only people in her family forever who've ever gone to college. So there's just this idea of everybody was just surviving. And so I feel like I was really the first person that was kind of given this idea of like, go forth.
Yes.
And see what you can make of this life.
Right.
So yeah, it's interesting.
I think what you just said is key, because it's a sort of thing where like, and I think that's for my family too. And just when I think about my cousins, I have some that are like maybe 15 or 20 years older. But even, and I think it starts with them. Whereas, you can go get an education, get a Catholic education.
Right.
Like, because my aunt, my dad's oldest sister, she taught in the DC public schools, but all her kids went to Catholic school.
Mm.
And then
which is a private. Private
school.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's like, okay, well, this is the type of education that you're going to get. And then like my dad said to me one time, he said, you never questioned the fact that you were going to college. It was just a matter of how I was going to get it done, how me and your mother were going to get it done, because that's what I was around.
Yeah.
So I was around like people that were like, oh yeah, you're going, this kid is going to this school. And this kid, I always tell the story about my high school where, when you get the report cards, they have this glass case of every class, like freshman class, high honors, honor roll, like the GPA. Oh. It would be like Ashley Brooke Roberts, 3.8. And you would like, literally fucking look and see who had what.
Yeah.
And when it was time for graduation, they would have all the schools you got accepted to and how much money you like. And so, I mean, that's what the game was. Yeah. So it wasn't, and telling my parents, like, I forgot how I said it to him. It was pretty funny. I think I made him laugh, where it was just like, we were talking about something, and it was just sort of like, I remember saying something like, yeah, I'm not that good with, like, they said, yeah, you never cared about cars. We were talking about cars.
Mm.
And I was like, yeah, you never know how good a car is until you get one that's like, until you sit in a really nice one. And like, I had a Hyundai Sonata that got totaled. And when it got totaled, Enterprise gave me a Nissan Maxima. And an Altima.
Yeah.
And it was like a 26, it was a nice car. It was nice. Yeah. It was better than the one that I had.
Right.
And I was like, God, I kind of like that Maxima. Now, of course, a Benz or all BMW would be fucking great.
Right.
But it's like, oh, this car is like great. And then they were like, yeah, my dad was like, yeah, you never really into cars. I was like, yeah, well, you guys, I forgot what the fuck it was. And maybe
I understand what you're saying, and I want to try and paraphrase
Go ahead, do it.
Are you saying that like you don't really, you're not really aware of something unless you experience it?
Yeah.
So you're not into cars because you weren't sitting in very fancy cars. You weren't having that experience. Is that the idea?
Well, it was just like, I mean, my dad would get, I mean, they had like,
they would get new cars and stuff.
Yeah.
But one thing, though, they could have gotten better cars if they didn't send me to Catholic school.
You know, this is something that I don't think we've discussed before, but I feel like it's coming out of this conversation.
Okay.
So a big part of this sort of getting out of North Carolina and having this mindset was that my parents always put me in situations where I was exposed to a higher class.
Yeah.
So like Montessori school, for example, like I was always aware that like I always felt like sort of the lone wolf, sort of the black sheep in these situations. But I was exposed to people who were living like a middle class or an upper middle class life. And I think because I was exposed to that, it gave me sort of the agency to imagine myself in those situations. And then so I would then... That felt like something I could do.
Something you could aspire to.
Right. Yeah. Whereas I don't think my family prior to that had that situation.
Yeah. It was always, for me, it was just kind of like my dad had a full-time job, he had a part-time job. My mom worked. And we were just like middle class. Like I was doing Don Will's podcast a couple years ago. You know Don Will, right?
I don't think so.
DJ's Night Train.
Oh, yeah.
And so we were talking, and I was trying to figure out, I was like, yeah, you know, I was like the black Kevin Arnold, you know, from the Wonder Years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like my dad worked and, you know, never wanted for anything. But I just remember some, like, they would say, oh, yeah, this family, some of their friends had, they always get the new cars, but the kids go to public school and they didn't, like, they're still kind of, anyway. It was sort of a thing where we were talking about, like, yeah, I was never like a man's man, like nuts and bolts of a car. And I was like, well, you guys sent me to a school where, you know, I like theater.
Yeah, and educational credentials were put in a glass case in front of everyone. Yeah.
I was like, I'm an artist.
Yeah, yeah.
So that sort of thing. But I think they just kind of put me in the situations to want that kind of shit or to aspire to be something. So it was never... It was never, I got to get the fuck out of here. So basically, I said all that to say, it was never like, I got to get the fuck out of Maryland. It was just sort of like, this is the natural progression.
Yeah.
And this, and I remember, because I told him, I remember it, because this just happened a couple of days ago. I said, I never wanted to get, you guys put, and I told him, I was like, you guys put me in the position to be successful. When I auditioned for grad theater school, I got in and I was like, hey, you think we can do this? And like, I got some scholarship money, but then they were like, yeah, we'll see. We'll make it happen. So like, that was sort of the thing. So it was never like, I gotta get the fuck out of here. And I think I have to remind them of that sometimes.
Yeah.
But I love where I'm from, but it is, it's a different thing. And you don't think about it. Like, I'm sure you probably don't think about it until it's brought up.
I had to get the fuck out.
Okay.
Which is what, because I saw my life going in two different directions.
Okay.
Very clearly. I saw it being sort of the staying in North Carolina, being a hairdresser, marrying an air conditioner repairman, living in a double wide, and having like a daycare that I ran in the day and then cut hair at night. Like I saw that future very clearly.
Do you talk about that on stage?
No, but I should, I guess.
You should, yeah.
That was very, that was like, because I feel like I've always straddled both worlds in that like sort of, you know, like I know both worlds well. So, then, but I knew that there was this other option. So it was like, I have to throw in all of my weight to get myself out. And I guess I don't really think about it. I didn't really think about it that much until I brought Nick, who was my boyfriend, home to meet my family, which was very stressful.
How long have you guys been dating? And then
we've been dating for about 6 years.
Okay.
And he's from New Jersey.
What part?
He's from, Hazlitt or Middletown, somewhere in there.
Okay. I might know the county if I looked it up. Okay.
I think maybe Monmouth County. Monmouth?
I know Monmouth County. Yeah. Cause there's a university there or a college.
I don't know. It's sort of like Southern New Jersey.
They were in my undergrad's conference, the NEC, Northeastern Conference, Monmouth.
Monmouth, yeah. The N is silent.
Yeah.
Monmouth. Yeah. So that's where he's from.
Sure.
So I guess I brought him down. You know, he came and he, when I moved, when we moved in together, he came and met my parents, which was a big deal. And then meeting my grandparents was, that was the stressful part. And
why was it stressful?
I think that they have...
living in sin or something?
So many reasons. So, okay. I mean, it was stressful because he's not the kind of guy. So, my dad's mom loved him. Mm-hmm. That was, I was never worried about Granny.
Yeah.
I was worried about Nana and Papa because they have ideas of me marrying a, your classic good old boy. You know, they want me to marry a guy who hunts. They want me to marry a guy who can farm, you know, like they can't believe I'm still here. They cannot believe I'm still here. They like keep waiting for me to move back. I think they, I think maybe the past couple of years they've been able to like be like, okay, I guess you're not coming back. But, you know, Nick is like, he's a guy from New Jersey, you know, like they've never really been exposed to that. He's Catholic.
Yeah.
You know, like that is
pizza.
He eats pizza.
Says, what the
he has a last name they can't pronounce, you know, Maritato. They're like, you know, so they're, they are very much country people.
Okay.
And so I was worried. I know that they were going to like love anyone that I loved, but I was just worried about like, are they going to be able to, are we going to eat our dinner in silence? Are they going to be able to talk to each other? Like, is there going to be such a cultural gap here?
And how old are your, are those grandparents?
They're young too. So I come from a long line 60s, of teen brides. 70s? Yeah. So they were, they're in their like late 60s.
Okay.
Early 70s.
My parents, they're the same age as my parents. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So when all of them, so like I had a great grandmother around until I was like in my 20s. So it's like everyone has had a, had a kid before. Besides me in their teens. So
is that, do you get shit for that?
I think everyone was very happy I did not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's, yeah.
Because I think that like the women and I think I got some shit from the men, or not like shit, but you know, it's,
but just like looking at you different, not like you're, not like you're Hester Prynne, but just
right,
or just like a witch, but it's just like, what, like what's your deal?
No, yeah, no one has ever verbalized this to me, but I have felt it, which is this feeling that, like, no matter what I do, my worth is really tied up to some male family members and my childbearing skills. Mm-hmm. So it's like, to some family members, I feel like I could go to the moon and they'd be like, but did you have a baby? You know? Like, and then I think for the women, they were kind of like, we love our children, but we, they ruined our lives. You know, we, like once you have a kid,
it's over.
And you're a teenager. Yeah. So, oh, sorry about that microphone. So, but I think, I don't know where I was going with this. Oh yeah. So I bring Nick down.
Yes.
And it was actually, it was like a little rocky at first, but then we all got along and we were all laughing and, you know, good thing is that everybody's funny, which is important. Humor really is like the great connector.
Sure.
You know, and but he got like a little weirded out a couple of times. Like my grandfather wanted me to bring a gun to my mom because we were going to go see my mom. And I was just like, sure. I put it in the Jeep. And then Nick was like, what, we were going to bring this like gun across state lines.
What kind
and
of
it's,
gun?
It was just like a little six shooter because he was, they were trading. And then it was like, cause he, she has this like rifle that he wanted. And so he was sending her a six shooter and then she was going to send him the old rifle and like, and none of them are registered. And it's like, Nick was like, I don't feel comfortable with you driving with this unregistered gun in the car across state lines. And I'm like, I've never heard that. I've never heard anyone say that. And it was like, I was like, oh, I guess, okay. I guess I won't take it. Like I hadn't considered that. And at my grandfather's house, there's a gun in every room. So it's like, you can, there's so no matter what, like you always have one around you.
Of course.
And so that was really strange and made Nick very uncomfortable, which I had not expected.
It does make you uncomfortable, don't it?
No.
You grew up with it.
Yeah, I grew up around, like, everyone had loaded guns around. And, you know, I don't even know if the safeties were on or off. I just always knew that I was taught not to, you know,
not to touch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were always around, and I knew where they were. My mom had a gun. My, you know, my dad had many guns. Everyone has guns. Everybody has so many guns, and it feels like just a part of my life in a way that I had never questioned it.
Sure,
because
that's all you knew.
That's all I knew.
Right.
And so there would be like things like that with Nick, where he would be like, what the fuck? You can't bring this unregistered mm-hmm. gun across state lines in the car with that, and I'm driving. And me being just like, oh, well, I guess I never thought that. And
did you call him a queer?
No, I didn't. I was just like, okay. He actually shot a gun for the first time recently in our most recent trip to North okay. Carolina, which was very exciting because he had never shot a gun before, which is, once again, very odd to me. As someone,
I've never shot one.
Really?
No.
See, I mean, I was shooting guns when I was like 7, you know? Like, these are, I feel like there's all these adult, first time I ever had chewing tobacco, I was 7, you
what?
Know? Yeah, so it's like, there's all these things that, to me, feel very normal, but yeah. when you bring someone who hasn't been in that environment there. But on our way, we were driving back to North Carolina to see my dad, and Nick just like grabbed my hand and he was like, I'm so impressed that you made it out of here. And that was like the first time where I was like, oh yeah, it was really hard to get out.
Wow. Because when I think of North Carolina, especially like I've only been introduced to like Chapel Hill, Durham more recently, like within the last 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Yeah. It's like so wonderful.
Like that whole Research Triangle area.
Yeah.
Is
don't
just,
tell anybody.
It's yeah. the best. It's great. And there's a friend of the podcast friend that I don't know if you're a sports girl or anything.
Sort of college basketball.
There's a sports personality on ESPN, Bomani Jones, who he's blowing up now. And
yeah.
I did this festival in, North Carolina Comedy Arts Festival.
Yeah.
Have you done it?
No, but I know it exists. Are you talking about the one in Chapel Hill?
Yes.
That's at the, it's like Dirty South Improv or
yes,
something?
Yes, yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. There and a couple other rooms. And it was a really fun festival.
Yeah.
He used to have a radio show and he was stationed. He lived in that area. And he came to the show and he loved North Carolina. And
yeah.
he was like, he said, yeah, I'll never leave. And then now he's in New York because of his job. Like
yeah.
he's, you know, he's getting really successful. But it's that type of place where it's like, why would anybody leave?
Yeah.
Now, like that area. But
well, that's very different than where I came from.
Right.
So I feel like my parents, they were super liberal. Like mm-hmm. my dad had this very strong, my grandmother, you know, broke tradition from her family, was disowned by her family for going to college. Disowned,
wow.
did not speak to any of her family for going to college. She became a Methodist. She was like very important in desegregating Virginia schools. So she was like, she's like a hardcore activist.
What's her name?
Her name is Eunice Devine.
Okay.
It's now, well, it was Eunice Vi, and now it's Eunice Devine. And she's still like a hardcore activist. Like she had my dad older. So she was not a teen mm-hmm. bride. She had my dad at the ripe old age of 26. And she lives in Texas now, but she's like very, she like, her local paper publishes all of her anti-Trump poetry. Like she is,
oh wow,
she is still and very optimistic. The whole Trump thing was a low blow for her, in the sense that, I mean, she's never going to listen to this, so I can just say it. But she's, you know, she fought so hard her whole life, politically and with act, you know, and she just saw things changing
mm-hmm.
and she always had this belief in the forward momentum of humanity.
Yeah.
And so I think getting towards later in her life where she might not have that many years left, she's seeing things kind of go back. And I think that that has been very hard for her. And it's been kind of hard for me to witness. I'm tearing up a little bit.
That's fine. That's fine.
because I just know how, you know, her foundation of who she is sort of this belief in progress.
Right.
And so to see that kind of going back has been difficult. But, you know, I talked to her like a week ago and I was upset about some news thing. And then she said to me, like, you know, she's like, you just have to keep doing, you know, what you're doing, and we all have to, and everything's going to work out. So she's back to her feeling positive. Not super positive, but not so much despair as she was the first couple of months of 2017. I don't know where I was going with that. Oh yeah, so I still don't know where I was going.
You were basically talking about your grandmother and how she left, and she was like the black sheep and for leaving.
Yes, and then my mom was like super rebellious against her family. Mm-hmm. None of her other siblings were. They all live within 10 minutes of their parents.
Yeah.
So she was super rebellious against her family. She went to she was the first and only person of her family besides me to go to college. She went to UNCW. That's why we were in Wilmington.
Yeah.
And she got a philosophy degree, and she was just like, you know, she used to tell me things, you know, like marriage is just an institution to control women. She was very, she was young. She was like 19, 20, 21, 22, talking to me about like very radical ideas. And so when I lived in Chapel Hill, that's super liberal, super educated.
Yeah.
And like I said earlier, I feel like I've always straddled both worlds, because then like I feel like very comfortable in that space, besides the fact that I have an accent, which none of my peers did in Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm also, you know, my grandparents are like very on my mom's side, that family. I'm very close to them, but they're super country, super country.
What I want to do now is, I guess, I want you to talk about, I guess, being on the precipice of coming here, but I want to go back into, like, where you are right now as far as being a white woman in Trump's America. What's that done to you,
mm-hmm.
and how do you feel about that 53% thing and
right.
all that stuff?
So being a white woman with a... Okay, my presence is very triggering to myself, because I...
You're gonna fall out of this chair.
Especially when I say things like, you know, the first time I ever chewed tobacco, I was 7.
Yeah.
You know, like, so I'm very much aware of what it is to be... I mean, I have so many feelings, and there's so much history with my family in the mm-hmm. South. And you know, like, I'm related to the Sally Hemings, Thomas Jefferson line.
Oh shit.
And I just cite that just because everything it's so convoluted and strange, and there's so much past stuff that I feel like is coming up in the modern, and I am at a little loss for words,
mm-hmm.
Because it is so emotional. Okay, so the 53% of women who voted for Trump, they can go fuck themselves. I feel like something with white women that I find is that they tend to really relate to, or they tend to be tied, not relate, but they tend to identify themselves by their gender. Whereas I feel like my black female friends tend to identify themselves by their race. So it's kind of like what, you know, in that way. And I've always identified myself by my social class.
Mm.
So I've, because I have always felt, because of the, just the country, the poor country people.
Sure.
And then being in these educated spaces like Chapel Hill, where I have always been so aware of class and how class plays into things like racial politics as well. Because it's just, I mean, I feel like I could talk about that forever, which I'm very tempted to do at this very moment.
Do it. Where I asked you.
Yeah, yeah. I just feel like, you know, growing up in North Carolina, and I lived in Savannah for a while, there were, racism felt like, racism so obvious and everywhere, you know, like people who are like, it's gone, it's a thing of the past. I mean, that's insane. Literally insane. And it's like in the South, I felt like people were very... It's impossible to be a poor white person and not be very closely related to poor black people. Okay.
Right.
You know, like it's, and, but in New York, there seems to be this segregation of class where it's like, everyone's like, we're not racist, but then they're all class, like everyone's separated by class.
Oh yeah.
And we're in, it's like in the South, everyone is put together, but they're racist. I don't know. Is this making any sense at all, what I'm trying to say?
Like here, it's like everybody's on top of each other. There's what I guess sort of like a tolerance, if you will, or yeah. just like, I gotta fucking work with you. I like the stuff you make at your bodega.
Yeah.
We're a little more of a commute. My dad said to me when I always say now that I feel like I got the vocabulary for it.
Yeah.
I went to a Dear White People school.
Yeah. I don't know what that is.
There's a show. It's a show on Netflix.
Oh, right.
About
right.
like this, a segment of like black kids that are at a predominantly white institution for yeah. undergrad. And so it's really good. And it was based on a movie, but I went to a predominantly white liberal arts college, and it was in Klan country. It was in Emmitsburg, Maryland, which is 15 minutes south of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And a neighboring town was Taneytown, which is this named after this guy. I think he was a Supreme Court judge, Roger B. Taney. And he was involved with this Dred Scott case about, oh, shit, I'm getting out of my waters without the internet. But it was racist as fuck. I went out in that town. Some kid got beat up by the KKK at mm-hmm. this place called Sheets, which I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I know Sheets.
So, and it's just like that element around there. And my dad would always say, he said, you know, one thing about the South is you, for the most part, you know where you stand with people.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little more subversiveness up in the North.
Okay, so my mom's friend, Marianne, who mm-hmm. is an older black lady, said when I moved to New York, her comment was like, in the South, they don't care how close you get. They just care how big you get. In the North, they don't care how big you get. They just care how close you get. Meaning like in the South, like we're neighbors, but you better not be a doctor. Like I don't care how close you are, but you better not think you're better than me.
Oh,
you better,
yeah, definitely.
Like, so I don't care how close you get. I just care how big you get. And then in the North, it's like they don't care how big you get. You can be a doctor, but we do care how close you get. So mm-hmm. like, so she's like, it's different racism in that way. So I don't know if that like...
It's kind of the same. It's almost like it's complicated, but then it's not.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like in corporate America, there's things you got to deal with. There's things that, you know, there's like, we were talking about this at your show last week, where we were just kind of, everybody was just kind of talking about stuff, and we were talking about feminism, and then, but like the intersectionality,
mm-hmm.
where it's like some like minority women feel like, yeah, we're feminists too, but you're kind of holding us back,
right?
Like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's just go ahead, you're about to say something.
I mean, I don't mean to always, also with the feminist thing that you were talking about, and that I've always kind of critiqued it under a class element as well.
Sure.
Because it's kind of like the, you know, especially like second wave feminism, it's like these are rich women.
Mm-hmm.
They're not talking about the poor women who were folding their clothes, which is also speaks to right. race as well.
Yeah.
So looking at it through that lens, yeah, we were, yeah.
I'm looking up this guy, Roger B. Taney. He was the fifth Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, holding that office from 1836 until his death in 1864. He delivered the majority opinion in Dred Scott versus Sanford that ruled, among other things, that African Americans, having been considered inferior at the time of the United States Constitution was drafted, were not part of the original community of citizens, and whether free or slave could not be considered citizens of the United States. That was a town that was like right next door to Emmitsburg.
Mm.
And I remember growing up, I grew up in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is like the, at one point, maybe it still is, like the highest concentration of upper to middle class blacks in mm-hmm. America. At one point it was. I don't know if it still is. There used to be a school, Roger like B. Taney Middle School, and they eventually turned it into Thurgood Marshall.
Okay.
But like it was just yeah. like it was interesting. I was just thinking about that when, you know, all the monument talk, and, you know, it's yeah. still going on, but it just made me think about, oh, yeah.
Oh, God, I really, they need to take down all those monuments. And it's like, I feel there's so much to be proud about being a Southerner, like a rich literary history.
Sure.
You know, like such beautiful natural landscapes. Mm-hmm. And the fact that like monuments come up, these things come up when people talk about, the fact that the term Southern pride is immediately yoked to these Confederate monuments is so embarrassing. And it makes me so mad, and it's complicated because I am this like white woman who is like deeply embedded in the South with my family.
It's like, what made you who you are, the good 100%. And the bad, you know? Yeah.
And
but
so,
the good, you know.
It's so embarrassing, and it's like so shameful, but it's like, and I just, you know, it really sucks.
It really sucks.
And I know my ancestors, you know, played horrible parts and horrible things. I know that. I know I had ancestors who fought in the Civil War on the Confederacy. 100%. And we have a family graveyard, and they have their, you know, Confederate monument or Confederate tombstones there.
Wow.
And I know that like my family, everything. It's just I don't know. What would you do? You know, like.
I think, I mean, you learn about history so you don't repeat it,
right?
And
yeah,
you,
yeah, of course.
And you have to. I think there's a really good movie, the James Baldwin doc. I'm Not Your Negro.
I love him.
Have you seen it?
I have not seen it, but...
Do you have Amazon Prime?
Yes.
Then it's free on Amazon Prime.
Great.
I thought, my listeners know this, but when I went to go see it, my favorite movie theater, they also know this. It should be a drinking game every time I say, my listeners know this, or I mention something, whatever, fuck. Anyway, I'm just telling you because you're new to the show.
Yeah.
But my favorite movie theater in this area, Jacob Burns Film Center, is in Westchester, is in this town called Pleasantville, New York. And it's just a small town. It's like a quiet town, but they've got this non-for-profit movie theater. For a nerd like me, I can go see independent films without having to trek all the way into the city.
And go to Sunshine or something.
All that shit, yeah. So I'm Not Your Negro open there like earlier this year, and I'm watching it, and I'm like, yeah, this is really, really good doc. This is amazing. James Baldwin was a incredible mind. This movie's not for me.
Huh.
It's for white people.
Oh, interesting.
You know, so I was just watching. I was like, yeah, this is, I know this, and he's speaking to something more eloquently than I could ever do. But it's like, it's not for me. It's for white people to consume and say, and grapple with that history and say, well, how can I change it? Because it's not going to change. It's just like, spousal abuse or male chauvinism, misogyny is not going to change unless the powerful class says, hey, this is wrong.
Right. The person who has the dominant narrative has to speak about
it. And it has to be like, whoa, this is like, and I think like a lot of white America, just like I'm talking about this, just like talking about Insecure, it's fine.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Insecure where it's like, oh, this is making me look at things that I don't like about myself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to deal with that.
Right.
So it's like, no, there's no racism. It's just like that gaslighting where it's just like, this isn't a thing.
Yeah. Are you a James Baldwin fan?
I think he's great. Yeah.
What's
I think he's.
Book?
I read Go Tell It on the Mountain.
So good.
I remember doing a scene in my first year in grad school where it was like, I forget where it was like, wasn't somebody a hairdresser in that? It's been so long.
I don't know. He was outside of a barber shop. There was preaching outside of the barber shop.
And there was like a husband arguing with his wife. It was one scene where like in this guy, this white kid.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
This white kid from the Midwest. He said he cried after the scene because it was kind of like this discourse on God, and he was like this super religious guy, and he never had like heard people, like, I guess the cons for God, or just like just the people that are overly religious,
yeah,
and not like just so far gone where it's like nothing else matters, and it's like you can't connect with anybody when you're all the way in the clouds.
Totally.
So he kind of had a breakdown.
I have never seen anything performed from Go Tell It on the Mountain. I've never seen a monologue performed from it. I'm sure that was amazing.
It was fun. I mean, you know, I was, what, 22 doing this? It was fine. Yeah. It was amazing. But
I bet you were wonderful.
It was fun. It was just like a scene study and whatnot. But I do remember that, but I would not consider myself to be like a scholar of his stuff.
Right.
I need to be more literate. Like I was reading the Ta-Nehisi Coates piece. Mm-hmm. Did you read that?
Which one are you talking about?
It's an essay that came out in the Atlantic like Wednesday or Thursday.
Oh, it's recent? Then I have not.
And it's an excerpt from his a new book that he's got coming out in October. And I was reading through that, and then I was just like, I was like, oh my God, like this is amazing. It's just like he's speaking to things. I don't know, like I was reading that thing, and it just made me, I was Googling words. Like,
yeah.
It's just like the way that I would rap genius Kendrick Lamar's album.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, or anyone who's got this text that's like, that you need to like decipher. And it was just like the totally. Whole time, it was just like the history of, you know, like racism in this country and what Trump really means, like why it's, I think it's called the first white president. And like, he had to erase Obama's presidency by really being.
Oh, interesting. Cause when you asked me if I'd read his piece in the Atlantic, I was thinking about the one that he did a few months ago called My President Was Black, and it was about Obama, and I think that was also in the Atlantic. So I wonder if this is a companion piece.
The first white president, the foundation of Donald Trump's presidency is the negation of Obama's legacy. Mm. So he goes in and just like, it's just like, fuck. It's a really good read, but it's just kind of like.
And does he touch on James Baldwin?
No.
Or are you just saying that he's in the? Is he the next James Baldwin?
I don't want to put that on, but it just like we were talking about that. I was just thinking like these great minds that kind of that they speak to like any great artist will speak to things that you have emotions about, but you can't necessarily put it into words or you can't articulate it as well as they can. Mm-hmm. And it's a powerful piece, but it just makes me think about like this complicated history that we have as a country. But it's like it's resting on white America to acknowledge it. And I think this election, it's awakened a lot of people, and minorities have been like, we told y'all. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not using you as the white,
oh, no.
But it's just like, we told y'all like,
I wasn't surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
whenever someone says that there's no longer racism, they are just living in a dream world. And I've never understood it, especially in the South. Cause you definitely get a brand of like very satisfied white people who don't think there's anything.
It's just about sides, like my team won. Like even Bill Burr says, the red ties beat the blue ties. And so like that's what it is. So it's just kind of like we won, but then you got to really like, because, okay, so like D.L. Hughley was saying like in an interview, he's like all these people that claim to be Christian, like you got to really hate black people to like elect this guy that's going to take away your health care. Like I hate black people so much that I'm going to deny myself coverage or all these benefits that help me to live like a human.
Yeah.
In order to, you know, wipe away Obama's.
And I think that with that, and I'm, who knows, you know, and I could be completely wrong here, but I think that like a lot of times that is like not acknowledged consciously because mm-hmm. everything is so ingrained. And when you're talking about like seeing movies, you know, and reading books and having dialogue, it's so important because people will eventually say something that they shouldn't, or they will say something that exposes an ignorance or a, yeah. you know, sort of like ingrained racism that they're not even aware of. And not to say that, not to like cast, I'm not trying to say they're innocent because I do believe it's the individual's job to examine their own belief system.
Yeah.
But I just think it's so important to be vocal because then when you do say something, someone can be like, "You, that was fucking racist." And then, and then yeah. that changes, you know, if they have, you know, if they're open to that. But I do think, I don't want to say that like they're not aware of it because there is, it is up to everybody to examine their own beliefs. But like there are things that I had beliefs that, or just things I assumed were just true. Mm-hmm. And then examining them as like in college where I was like, oh fuck, that's racist. Like, for example, I remember having this, I being told at some point that like the fact that, slaves were freed in America and that there wasn't total genocide was a testament to the fluidity of democracy. So it was kind of like, it shows that we're not a dictatorship and that America has the plasticity to grow, like we are able to grow. And so I always took that as like, look at America, look at America. And yeah. then later when I got really into social politics, I was like, or when I got very, you know, I was dabbled in anarchism and got very political in college. And I was like, oh no, uh-uh. That happened. A big part of that is because America is a capitalist yeah. country.
Right.
And we continued to need cheap labor and right. we continue to need a class of people to exploit. And so yeah, anyway, I just think that there are things like that that it's just such a awkward process and that everyone needs to talk because then you something eventually comes out.
Yeah, because we got to deal with it, like we yeah. you got to deal with the shit to come out of it. I mean, it's I think it's what we need to do. Like I hear the term, oh, this is the last death cry of the country of the race. I don't think it is. I mean, you saw those are young ass people in Charlotte, yeah. Charlottesville.
Yeah.
Like they're that Nazi Comic-Con, that was like those dudes were young.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I don't know. It sucks. But on a lighter note, I guess I want to talk about you being on the precipice, get back to you like leaving, like yeah. so what was, so you're in college, where'd you go to school?
I went to NC State. So first
Wolfpack.
Wolfpack. First I went to beauty school and I dropped out.
What was that like? So you are a beauty school dropout.
I'm a beauty school dropout. I went to beauty school in Burlington, and
so that's near
where you're,
we were talking yeah. about Elon College, because I was trying to ask my dad where, because after our conversation I was telling him about you. And I was saying, yeah, one of my comedian friends is, she went to beauty school in Burlington. But I was trying to think, like, what my aunt's mailing address is. And I think her mailing address is Elon College.
Oh.
So, they're near Reidsville. Did you know about Reidsville? Did you ever?
I know about Reidsville in the sense that I, like, know it exists.
Okay.
But I've never
yeah, yeah.
been there.
It's really small. Yeah. It's just like they... Like, it, when I was a kid, it was the shit, because
yeah.
there was a, we would go to the mall, which is basically a strip mall that was flagshipped by a Roses.
Gotta love a Roses.
And a Belk.
Gotta love a Belk.
So, like, it had that, and then we would just go to, there was an arcade there, and my grandmother would take us to McDonald's. Then there was a Food Lion, a Kmart, and a Winn-Dixie. So yeah, that's all. Yeah. It's just a small town. But
yeah.
it was like to them that was the city.
Yeah,
yeah. So enough about me. Go.
Oh yeah, so I went to beauty school.
So you went to beauty school first.
Mm-hmm. I went there for 6 months, or yeah, look, give or take.
Eight? Were you like 18?
I was 17, and I turned 18 while I was there.
Oh, so did you? So you technically graduated early.
I graduated as a 17-year-old. Yeah.
Okay.
Because I was like. My birthday is July 31st, and there's something there with, like, enrollment. I don't really know how it works, but I was always the youngest in my class.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So beauty school and dropped out.
So why beauty school and not college first?
Well, I thought that I was going... I did not do well in high school.
Okay.
I was very troubled youth.
Because of moving and...
Yeah. And like I got, yeah, lots of moving and, you know, maybe not the most solid home life.
Sure.
And then I got very into like punk and, you know, which led into, which I'm happy about because it led into politics later. But I was like very, I was very rebellious.
What'd you dress like?
I had a mohawk.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
you're like, yep.
Yeah.
I did.
I had bihawks at one point. I had two mohawks I would spike up. you know, I wore a lot of, I would go, me and my friends, I had like a little posse of girls that were, we were a very tight group.
What are we talking? Late 90s?
Yeah. Okay. Late 90s.
Yeah.
And we would go and go to thrift stores and make very elaborate outfits and sew them. And we did a lot of very creative things together. We made like zines and little short films. And
okay.
We were always doing very creative stuff. We just weren't doing academic stuff. And, you know, I had a boyfriend who had like a little Vespa. So, you know, I was living a life.
Right.
And so I didn't graduate with high honors.
But you graduated.
I did graduate.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, how am I going to get out of North Carolina? How am I going to get out of North Carolina? I was like, I'll go to beauty school. And then I had this idea that I was just going to sort of be this like world traveler, like cutting hair and just traveling wherever. Because I was like, if I'm a hairdresser, I can go wherever I want.
Sure.
And I was also a makeup lady at the mall. So at Dillard's, I would like put on people's
Dillard's
makeup.
Mm-hmm. What mall?
Well, Dillard's, I was one at Northeast. What's it called? So it became South Square.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of my favorite, who's been on the show, Fonte Coleman of this rap group, Little Brother.
Little Brother.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know about,
oh, I love Little Brother.
Oh, my God. You're the first, one of the first, one of the
You've
few.
You've had Fonte on here?
Yeah, he's been on the show twice.
That's cool.
I'm
one of the few people who know?
Like, there's some people, like, there's people that know, but like... They're like, yeah, I know who they are, but like...
Well, Minstrel Show was like a great album.
Yeah.
Top
classic.
To bottom. Yeah.
Okay, little story. 2013, I was opening for Chris Hardwick. We played the Durham, Carolina Theater in Durham. Mm-hmm. And I invited Fonte because I had met him at an in-store in Union... What is it? Is it Union Square? I always forget what that is.
Where?
14. There was a Best Buy like in the Union Square area. Is that right?
There's New Hope Comets. Wait, are you
that?
What are you in? Are you talking about Durham?
We're talking about New York City now.
Oh, okay.
That's Union
yeah.
Square, right?
Union Square,
where the Whole Foods and all
yeah.
that shit.
Mm-hmm. Union Square Park. Yeah.
So I met him at that Best Buy. They did an in store, met him, and then we just followed each other on Twitter. And I invited him, and he came to the show. And Hardwick didn't know that he was going to be there, and so Hardwick likes to go into the audience. And he was like, I tend to talk to the audience members. And like, he's like, oh, what do you do? And Fonte was like, oh, I'm a musician. And he's like, what's your name? Fonte. And Chris Hardwick hosted the Minstrel Show.
Oh,
he hosted the album. He was the host.
That. Oh, my
yeah.
God.
Yeah. So that we had like a mini, like they had a mini
oh,
little.
That's cool.
And that's that album is an iconic, like it's event. It's to a lot of people, nerds
yeah.
like me. That's a huge album. And
it's a huge North Carolina
yes.
album. Yeah, it's
yeah.
so many North Carolina references. And I remember when it came out, there was like this. I think there was same with, you know, other North Carolina rapper, P.D. Pablo, even though
yeah.
they're in completely different
right.
Styles. But there was sort of this feeling of like North Carolina's going to do it.
And they could fucking rap. Like
yeah.
they were. I mean, Fonte, to me, he's in my top five MCs.
Right.
But this record, Good Clothes, on what's the 07 album? What the fuck, Chris? I'm getting old.
Was Ninth Wonder on the Minstrel Show?
Yes, he.
Okay.
Yeah, he
That's
was on that. What the fuck? Get Back, Get Back is a. He was this song called Good Clothes, and he said he would go to. I used to go to the mall down in South. His friend used to work at
South Square Mall at the J. Riggins. So he mentioned South Square Mall.
Square is different than South Point.
You worked at South Point?
I worked at South Point.
Why did I think South Square?
But I also worked at South Square.
There we go.
South Square was, South Square is now like a Super Target. Okay. It was a mall and it was in Durham, like right once, it was like, let's say 10 minutes out of Chapel Hill.
They're getting rid of those malls now.
They are. It's a shame. South Square was great. I love South Square. It was my first job. Uh-huh. I was a Lancome lady in Dillard's, and I felt like queen of the mall.
Like, so you're like this punk girl doing like these like fancy schmancy makeup?
So I was punk. So 14, 15, 16, I was very into punk.
Okay.
And then like around my senior year,
it's like I gotta get a job.
I started slowing down. Yeah. I started slowing down because all of my friends, so my girl group in 14, 15, and 16, they had all either dropped out or graduated early or were like living with their boyfriends. And so that's when I was pretty much I started becoming a different version of Ashley. I started growing up a little bit.
Looking at you, maybe you were kind of like Thora Birch in Ghost World in a way.
I don't think I saw that.
No?
No.
Okay. That's just me being a movie nerd. I'll pull it up. Keep talking.
My South Square years, I was wearing like, this is early 2000s. So it's like 2000, 2001, 2002. I was wearing a lot of like Juicy Couture. I was straight ironing my hair and wearing like black eyeliner and lots of self tanner. So I was like working at the mall in that fashion. I had acrylics. I had fake nails. I had the, you know, fake nails. And so that I was getting very into beauty school and mall work. And I had a lot of fun. And I was smoking a ton of weed. And just really living life. And so, where was I going with that? Mall, beauty school. Oh, yeah. So then I drop out of beauty school because it's so clear what my life is going to become. Oh, yeah. That's me. Yeah. That's totally me. Who is that?
Thora Birch.
Yeah. That's what I looked like.
Okay.
Yeah. I wasn't punk in like the sense of like, I had the mohawk, but this is much more at my alley.
She was in American Beauty. I think that was one of the last ones she did. She's kind of probably still around, but she was like hot. Like in her youth, and now maybe she's doing other shit.
Yeah, I had those glasses and the ringer tee, and dyed my hair a bunch of different colors.
And you were just beauty school mode. You're doing.
So
the
then
makeup.
When I got back to beauty school, I was like much more like it's time to grow up. Okay, and I'm going to grow up by being a little bit more together, and so. Beauty school, but then it was like very clear what my life was going to become because Burlington is very country.
Yes.
And you know, like all the girls there were like either pregnant or talking about getting pregnant, and they were my age. And I remember this one beautiful girl named Sheila. She came, she was just so beautiful. I loved Sheila so much. And she came in a couple of times with a black eye, and I was like, fuck, I'm going down this.
And you had to make her up and shit?
Oh, I didn't make her up. I just remember her explaining the black eye situation.
Ran like into there the was, door type
it
shit.
It would always, you know, it would, she would try and cover it up. And then by lunch, she'd be crying and telling us the real story. And so I was just being surrounded by a certain element. And I was like, this is the element that I thought I was going to be getting out of. I was going to be evolving out of, sort of. That makes sense?
You know what you make me think of? Because I think in movies a lot.
Yeah, great.
You know that movie Junebug?
Oh, I love Junebug.
So fucking great.
It's so good.
Yeah. Okay.
Amy Adams?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was her breakout role.
I relate to that character.
You related to her?
I relate to that character.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I felt like her husband was like my boyfriend at the time.
Okay.
Who was an air conditioner repairman. And it felt like that's just what we were, you know, it felt like everything was being set up for me to become her.
The way that they set the director set that up, like, this is one of the coolest ways to like show what people did at work, like to just like, I think it was just something like they cut to a name tag and then they just kind of showed them. It was just something brilliant about that I can't put my finger on
that I would have to see it again. I own the movie,
yeah,
but it was fucking great. Like that movie, yeah.
Yeah.
That was Winston-Salem where they shot that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So good.
Continue. I'm sorry. I'm just being
no, that's okay. I love going off on a movie talk. Yeah,
I do that sometimes.
So then I dropped out and I was like, fuck, what am I going to do? I don't know what I'm going
to
do.
So you dropped out without a plan. You just said, like, I'm putting a total halt to this.
Yeah.
And I got to figure it out.
I also started hanging out with this girl named Tracy in Burlington, and she was kind of bad news. We were smoking a lot of blunts after school, and so I wasn't necessarily going to school, and I was getting into some trouble with her, and so I was just dropping out. I was like, I got to get away from her. I got to get away from this school.
What did your mom say? Like,
my mom, that's a good question.
Were you with your mom or your dad?
I was with my mom at that point.
Okay.
So I lived with my dad in Chapel Hill, and then my mom came and she moved across the street, and then I moved in with her. So then my parents lived across the street from each other.
How was that?
It was awful. It was really bad. My mom always let me get away with everything though. So she was young, you know.
Did that kind of fuck you up? Like they're right across the street,
yeah,
and
they're
not in
up.
The same bed.
Yeah. It was awful.
Did they get along?
No, they didn't get along. They would fight with each other. I would fight with one of them across the street. You could, on any given day, you could drive by our street and maybe you would see me on my dad's side yelling at my mom, you know, and her yelling back at me.
Shit.
You know, like, who knows? In some ways, it was good because I had, like, different territories to go to where I knew the other one wouldn't lap over.
When you get a deal, your TV show is going to be good.
Thank you.
Damn.
So I had this neighbor named Don,
uh-huh,
who was an English teacher, and he would buy weed from me, or he would like help. I would facilitate him buying weed.
Shit.
And he was just like he was a very cool dude who was older, and I felt very comfortable talking to him.
How much older?
So he was probably in his late 30s when I was a teen.
And he was, like, trying to hit on you and stuff?
No. He wasn't trying to hit on me.
Oh.
It's always been very non-sexual.
Okay.
And we would just have very deep conversations. So there's an apartment complex that me and my mom lived in. And it was across the street from my dad's house.
Mm-hmm.
And Don lived in the apartment complex. And I was a cigarette smoker. And Don was a cigarette smoker. So we would sit outside and we would smoke cigarettes together and talk. And I was clearly very troubled. I got in trouble. I'd been arrested a couple of times.
Whoa. What did you get arrested for?
I got arrested for destruction of federal property.
Shit. What'd you do?
I graffitied a courthouse. Not a big deal. It is a felony. Why? Because I was an idiot. I don't know. Because I was an idiot. Yeah. I was just a stupid 15-year-old. That is a felony, unfortunately, but it is also not on my record because it was under 18. Mm-hmm. Then I had a misdemeanor for disorderly conduct because I was drunk and some of my friends were throwing things off of a parking garage. Anyway, so.
Wow.
So just, you know, I totaled my mom's car without a license. Lots of me just not playing, but me being a shithead.
And were you trying to get attention, though? Do you think that's what it was?
100%.
Looking back on it?
I had a very rough family life at the time. I don't know if I feel comfortable getting in on the podcast.
Sure. Okay. Whatever you feel comfortable about. Like, when you said arrest, I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was listening to you, but I was just like, whoa, okay.
I will say that there are things.
I think you're the first person that's admitted to being arrested on the show.
Oh, really?
Convict.
Yeah. I had a rough, there was a lot of things happening with my mom and my dad that were leading to me acting out with drugs. And, you know, I graduated high school with a 1.7 GPA. I had been arrested. I had totaled my mom's car. You know, I had to do community service for my felony.
What kind of stuff?
I had to do. I did 50 hours in a kill shelter, which was really hard.
Is that like where they kill animals, like pet, like stray cats and
dogs?
Yeah,
it's just it's an animal shelter, but where they have like a 2-week minimum for adoption. So it's like there's like kill shelters and non-kill shelters.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on one second.
Sure, yeah. And what did you have to do at the kill shelter?
I just just had to spray out litter boxes and wipe down kennels.
Did you get to see shit?
No, I didn't see shit, but it just didn't feel good.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. Jesus.
So, and like, there's a lot of other things that were happening, and, you know, I could talk to you about it off pod. But,
okay, yeah.
I'll say that, like, you know, rough teen years, so.
Sure.
Getting
damn, your Lifetime movie is gonna be lit. That shit is gonna be off the hook.
So I think when I dropped out of beauty school, I don't even know if anyone noticed, but who did notice was Don, who had had these conversations, who I had talked with, and
sure.
He was like very, he in a lot of ways, my teen years, there was not a parental guidance. So I could kind of go off and do things and no one was there to check on me. And in a lot of ways, Don was like a parental guidance where he would be like, oh, you shouldn't do that. Or you shouldn't hang out with someone who does something like that. And I'd be like, really? Interesting. You know? So I always listened to Don, and when I dropped out of beauty school, he was like, he's the only one whose reaction I remember where he was like, upset, and he was like, well, he was upset that I did it without a plan, and he was like,
that's the first thing I said to you.
Yeah, he was upset that I did it without a plan, and he was just like very much like, you absolutely have to go to college now. And I was like, I can't get into college. And he was like, you have to work. He like helped me figure out how to go to Durham Tech. So I went to Durham Technical Community College, and
you got your associates?
I got my associates, and then I transferred to NC State. So I'm kind of like a year behind my class. I'm like a year and a half behind my class, but I also graduated at 17. So it's like, it's kind of all comes out the same. But he was a big force in getting me and helping me stay in school, getting me into school, helping me stay in school. And then at NC State, by the time I got to NC State, I was like obsessed with education. And that's when I was very, very much like involved in reading as much as I could. That's when I first read James Baldwin.
So you kind of got all the evil out.
I got all the evil
out. I notice that about like a lot of people that I meet just like in the comedy game or just kind of people in general, where it's like, I used to be an alcoholic. I'm 28. Like, it's just like, oh shit. Okay. I was like, damn, fuck. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got all the evil out for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So you're reading Baldwin.
Yeah. I'm reading Baldwin. Yeah. I'm reading, you know, I'm just knee deep in literature and having the best time. And I'm an intern for a local paper.
Okay.
And
what paper?
The Independent. Which is sort of like North Carolina's Village Voice.
Okay, okay.
I end up breaking a really big story about a county official ties to dog fighting. It's huge.
You broke it.
I broke it.
How'd you do that?
I had this editor at the time, Jennifer Strom, who was just an incredible role model. Like, had her shit together, was on top of her game, and trusted me 100%. And she got a lead on a story, and she was like, I want you to look into it.
And you were just an intern, right?
I was just an intern. I was, like, writing music reviews and stuff like that, you know? And
I like this Natalie Imbruglia album.
Exactly. I was writing, like, the calendar of events for the week,
sure,
you know?
Sure.
And she was like, check this out, look into it. She's like, it could be nothing, but it might be something.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be something. And she, instead of taking over the story, like I think most editors would have, she helped me every step of the way with things I didn't even, you know, I didn't know how to investigate things. I didn't know how to go to a courthouse and look up land deeds. She ended up having me in a Piper plane flying over Tom Garner's backyard, who's the biggest breeder of fighting dogs in the world, and taking pictures of the pit bulls in his backyard.
You did that?
Me and a photographer.
So they let you in or you snuck?
No, we flew over the property plane. Yeah.
What's a Piper plane? It's a small plane, but what is it?
It's a small plane that has no sides or roof, so you can lean out.
Amelia Earhart type thing?
Yeah, it's a crank rudder in the front. It's a small plane. And, you know, sure enough, we're flying over Tom Garner's property, and you could see all of these little white discs from the air. And we're like, what the fuck is that? And as we got closer, we realized that there were pit bulls who were tied to logging chains, which are very thick chains that create basically they add, they're a big part of pit bulls building up body mass, a fighting dog building up body mass, because they have to fight against the weight of this chain, and that they had destroyed all of the grass in the circumference. So it looked just like these UFOs as we flew over it. And then as we got closer, we realized there was like a dog in the middle of those UFOs. Mm-hmm. So broke this big story about dog fighting, and it was very exciting.
Did you win any awards?
I did. No. So 6 months later, Michael Vick was arrested, and some of his dogs were Tom Garner dogs.
Okay.
And the FBI did get involved in my story. So I don't know how much, because they contacted my editor and she gave them a lot of the information that we had gone over.
Holy shit. So you took down Michael Vick.
You know, I don't...
You ruined his career, Ashley.
You know, it's so funny because it's like...
Now he's on Fox News because of you, Fox Sports because of you.
My grandparents are big Vick apologists. They're like, he fell into a bad crowd. He's a good man who fell into a bad crowd.
Now... You may not know this about me, and this is fucking awesome. This is, wow, this is legendary. So anyway, you don't know this about me. I'm a big proponent of black quarterbacks. I would consider myself to be very liberal when it comes to most things.
Yeah.
But I am a real conservative when it comes to them.
Yeah.
But I understand. That shit was fucked up.
Yeah.
What I will say is he paid his debt to society.
Yeah.
But now, I feel like now he's like become this thing where it's just like he's like he's almost, because he's now he's like telling Colin Kaepernick to get a haircut so he can get back in the league, and he's just kind of made it's this heel turn that black celebrities make in order to just keep themselves like afloat,
right?
Like where it's like. If you talk, basically, it's like if you talk shit about black people, if you're a black person, you talk shit about black people, you get elevation.
Ah,
so that's the sort of thing.
Interesting.
I just think it's funny, but you basically took him down.
I mean, I don't know how much of a role I played.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I played that big of a role, but I do know the FBI had all my information. And
yeah.
I do know that some of the dogs there were from Tom Garner, who again is the biggest breeder of fighting dogs in the world.
So this is like 04, 05?
Yeah. So this is 05. Yeah. This is 05.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. 05, 06.
Okay.
That time. Also, fun little thing about Michael Vick. About 6 months ago, Saturday night, very depressed, didn't have any shows. I don't know what was going on with me, but I went through my Facebook history to the very first Facebook message I ever sent, and it was to Michael Vick. And I did not realize at the time, you know, at the time I was like, you can just message whoever you want. So I had messaged Michael Vick like, hey, Michael, I'm a big fan, and I just think you're really great, and like all of this. So that is funny to think back.
Oh, and did he write back or anything?
No, he didn't write back.
Okay,
he didn't write
back. Oh, shit.
But the first, it's funny to me that I signed up for Facebook and the first thing I did was message Michael Vick. He's the first person
I sent
a message to. Because we're big Virginia Tech fans.
Yeah.
Or my dad's a Virginia Tech graduate.
Your dad's a grad. That explains it.
So everybody was like hoping for Marcus to take the torch after Michael Vick. He really fucked up. But my grandparents, who are the super country people, they're big Vick apologists. They're just, you know, he's a good man. He fell into a bad crowd.
Uh-huh.
So I break this story.
Part, they're kind of right. I mean, he fucked up. I mean, but they're kind of right.
You think they're right?
Yeah, he fell into he let those people like influence him. And
that's what my grandma said.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's like probably he's like kind of, there was a doc on him that's like on YouTube that I think was like a Bleacher Report doc. It's maybe like 45 minutes, but Newport News, I don't know if his dad was around, so I don't want to put that on him because you can confuse Michael Vick's backstory with Allen Iverson, sans the imprisonment, the bowling alley thing, but like, I can just imagine some of these young men that get rich and they don't have any influence, and then these other people, hey, we should do this.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably okay.
Yeah.
He didn't have to go around. He didn't have to fucking do it.
He didn't have to do it.
Yeah, but.
Yeah. But, I mean, my grandma would love you. Because
this
she's...
This is the gun-toting grandma?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We probably would get along.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure we would.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, especially if you were talking about Michael Vick.
I come to her house with a Michael Vick jersey.
Yeah. Yeah. She basically says the exact same thing. So.
I think that's... I honestly, at the core, I think that's what it is. Now, he didn't have to, he shouldn't have done it.
Right.
But, I mean, it sucked. Like, all that potential is just.
I know. It's a real bummer. Yeah. He was a role model in a lot of ways.
But I think he still, like, his second act is pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't like this turn that he's making. Because now, like, he said this shit about Kaepernick.
See, I'm not aware of any of this.
But you know about Colin Kaepernick, right?
I think so. Tell me.
So he's the guy that knelt for the...
Yes.
So you know about him.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot of people... There's people that make the comparison to Ali, but they say he's not Muhammad Ali. He wasn't as good at his sport. But at the same time, when Muhammad Ali died and the stuff that he stood for, people chastised him, treated him like shit. But then ESPN dedicates his funeral. They cut off all their normal programming to show his funeral, but it's like, which one is it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like now that he, you know, when he had Parkinson's and couldn't talk, that's when he became beloved.
Right.
And when he talked all his shit, when he was lucid, like that's when he was a problem. So it's just like, Kaepernick,
well.
These people, like Ali died, what, 2 years ago, that? And like, Kaepernick is trying to do something. There's people that can be on the right side of history to say even just speak up or
right.
say something, but they're not.
Yeah.
So, award.
Oh yeah.
Six months after the story comes out.
Yeah, like a year after I won an award from the Associated Press. And it was around the same for general news reporting.
That's amazing.
Thank you. I ran it. I shared it with the editor who had overseen the whole thing, Jennifer Strom. And then it was like around the same time I was graduating. And I was like, oh, my God, I can move to New York. And then.
Was it just New York? Was it just like.
Oh, it's always been New York.
You just wanted to move. You didn't know what you wanted to do? Did you?
Well, at the time.
You got an English degree.
Mm-hmm. I had an English degree. I mean, I've really lived 100 different lives. So at the time, my senior year in college, I was taking graduate classes in Southern literature. Because I really wanted to go.
Grad classes where?
At NC State.
Oh, still there.
So I was an undergrad, but I was taking graduate classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to go to Ole Miss and because they have a Southern Studies program. So I wanted to go there and do Southern literature.
Mm-hmm.
And then I imagined I'd be a professor. Because at the time I was, I was reading and writing a lot about Faulkner and really
as I lay dying,
really relating to this, you know, this sort of like the
it's like the Southern Gothic type thing.
Or? Yeah, totally. And just sort of the crippled Southern experience of that we're doomed and we're. For our forefathers, I mean, Faulkner writes about this mostly, which is like for because of our ancestors' sins, slavery, there is a shadow cast over the South that will ultimately destroy it. So it's like this watching the South shrivel up in Faulkner. And I don't know, I was just like super into it at the time.
Sure.
You know who else is very into it?
Who?
Japan. Japan has some of the best Faulkner critics in the world.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
That's crazy.
Because when I was looking at graduate schools, they have like Faulkner study programs in Japan. And I think it's because it's like this history of like secrets, honor, and like this idea of honor, this idea of secrets, and this idea of like horrible things in the past that we're dealing with today. So I was going to do Southern Studies with... really wanted to focus on Faulkner. And so I thought my best friend, Sarah, who I've been best friends with forever, Sarah Edney, we had always talked in high school about like New York, New York, New York. And she had ended up in New York after college. And so it was like, yeah, so we're going to do this. We're moving to New York. We're going to do this. So I had my degree. I had my award. She was there. I moved in with her immediately.
What area?
We moved into Greenpoint. She was living in Greenpoint at the time, and she was renting a room out from this guy who rented rooms out to like 5 different people, and I just lived in that room with her, and we shared a bed until we found an apartment. Mm-hmm. And
what year are we talking?
I guess this is 2007.
Okay. Same year I moved, 10 years ago.
Yeah. What a time.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Time flies.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got this job at a independent book publisher called Seven Stories Press that really aligned with my political beliefs. They're Howard Zinn's biggest publisher. I was working with Ralph Nader. I edited Alice Walker. I mean, I was like,
really?
Literally, yes.
Holy
I was
shit.
Having the time of my life. I could not believe it. I was like, fuck grad school. You know, like yeah. I'm doing grad school. And then I found comedy, and then that really messed everything up.
How did you find comedy?
It was truly, I felt it was kind of an accident. So I was a DJ on this radio station in Washington Heights.
What?
Yeah. So there was.
Wait, so what? Okay. Talk about that.
Well, it's a pirate radio station.
Okay.
Called Washington Heights Free Radio. And it was run by this woman named Veronica Liu, and she worked at Seven Stories Press with me. And so they were like very politically minded. It was a bunch of Columbia students who, a pirate radio station, you know, they had an antenna they put up and went in like a 10 block radius. Mm-hmm. And then the antenna got knocked off in a storm and they just went to the internet, you know. Okay. So it wasn't like on an actual radio station, I should say that. But she was like, do you want to do, because I had been a DJ at NC State. I was at NC State, I was a DJ
there.
I did
college radio.
I loved it.
What did you play?
You know, I tried so hard to get into rap and I got denied. I applied 3 times while I was there.
Because of the cursing or just like?
Why did I want to get into rap?
No, I mean what was the deal? You couldn't.
It was just like a boys club. Oh. I would have been the only girl because the rap was at NC State at the time. There was only like the 2-hour time slot for rap at night. Oh. And so when I was like, that's what I want to do. And they were like, well, you have to do regular programming first. And so I did regular programming, which was indie music.
Okay.
Which I was like fine with.
I used to just play R&B stuff.
Yeah.
Like I would play the B-sides of stuff. So I was there. I graduated in 02. The big time was like when D'Angelo's Voodoo came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I would play like Babyface's brother's music.
Mm-hmm.
And he was great, Kevin. We would play like what they would have called neo soul back then.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun. I loved that shit.
Mm-hmm.
So who were you playing?
So I didn't get much choice over my programming.
Oh, but
which is unfortunate.
What were you?
At the time, NC State, you had to play like a certain quota of songs for that hour of entertainment. So it was like what was popular in like 2005, 2006, like Radiohead. Mm-hmm. You know, I would sometimes be able to play like Dinosaur Jr., you know, stuff like that. I did a lot of talking.
What'd you talk about?
I think I just talked about my day. I didn't have much of a filter. I was so excited to be a college DJ. And yeah. so I would just talk about things that had happened to me. So
did you have any tapes?
I don't have any tapes. And I wonder if there are archives.
My dad still has tapes.
He has tapes of his.
Do you remember your call sign? Like your, I think mine was like, this is 89.9 WMTB, Emmitsburg, Maryland. High on top of the mount and low on your FM dial. It's the Chris Lambert Show giving you the best in R&B and soul music. Something like that.
I love that so much.
I fucking loved it. That's I love those playlists. So you don't remember any, like you don't have like the,
I don't remember.
The name of the station?
No. Or, it was 88.1 WKNC. That was the radio station.
This is 88.1. Mm-hmm, 88.1. Ashley Brooke Roberts.
Yeah, I think at the time I went by Schley. Like, but for you my DJ, so, for you, my DJ name.
You kind of remind me of of Will Ferrell in that cop movie. What's that movie? The other, was it The Other Guys?
where he had this life where he used to be a pimp.
Oh, I don't know.
Gator. I think that's the other.
Is that me?
It's just like you have so. It's very. You're fucking fascinating. Like it's so many different aspects of your life. It's interesting. It's cool.
I feel like we've been talking a long time. How long has it been?
Hour 48.
Damn! that's cool, though. I'm good with it.
No, it's good.
Okay.
I'm happy.
Good. Okay.
But you just keep taking me to these other
caverns. I know. We keep going to caverns. Another. Yeah.
There's so many facets.
A lot of facets.
So you're doing this radio show.
Are we at NC State or Washington?
NC State. I mean, you love doing it. You were playing indie stuff.
Yeah, the NC State one was more of like, that one wasn't as meaningful to me because I was really trying to get onto the rap station, the rap hour. And I wasn't able to. And then I just kind of almost did that as like, I never was invested in it. But then I got really into Washington Heights Free Radio. I had a show every Wednesday. At 7 p.m. called You Can Take It With You. And I did all sorts of different things. I played music. I would do, I would go on adventures and record myself and then play that and all sorts of stuff. So I'm working at Seven Stories Press during this time. This is sort of my New York awakening. I'm having the most amazing time.
Your Felicity moment.
My Felicity moment, 100%. Sure. I'm like biking from Greenpoint over the Williamsburg Bridge into Tribeca to go like talk to Ralph Nader at Seven Stories Press. Wow. And then, you know, going to Washington Heights and doing this radio show. And it was just like a really fantastic introduction to New York. And Columbia, so there a lot of the Columbia students listened to Washington Heights because Veronica had been a creative. She had gotten her master's in creative writing, and she was a Seven Stories Press employee. And so they would have these readings where they would organize readings at the Ding Dong, which was a bar in the Upper West Side, doesn't exist anymore. And it would be like all of these students who would come out and they would like read things. And so she asked me if I wanted to participate because it would usually be under the Washington Heights Free Radio umbrella to support the station, blah, blah, blah. And so I would read and there would always be like comedic monologues. And I didn't really understand that at the time. You know, I had never considered doing comedy. I mean, one time my dad was like, you should be a stand-up comedian. And I was like, I don't know what that means. You know, it was like.
Do you remember how old you were when he said that?
I was 19. Yeah.
Do you remember the situation? When he said it and why?
Yeah. I did like an act out of someone that we had just seen. I just like impersonated them and did like a little dance. And he was like, you should be a stand-up comedian. He's like, you do voices, you do dances. And I was like, I didn't. It was very much like what we were talking about earlier. When you are aware of what's available to you, you go for it. I was never aware that comedy was something that I could pursue. Like, my family wasn't into comedy. They were very funny, but they weren't into stand-ups. So I didn't really have a reference for it, you know? The only female comedian I knew was Ellen DeGeneres. So it was like, entering comedy didn't seem like a thing. I mean, I had like fucking Andy Griffith's comedy album, American Original, but, you know, that wasn't... you know, you get it. So,
sure, of course.
So then I do these readings and then people would be like, oh, will you come do my show? And then I would go and like this one that I did was for this women's group and it was at Lolita in Chinatown, which is a bar.
Yeah. They used to, what's the name of the show they used to do there?
Was it?
Liam McEnany?
Yes. What was his show?
What was the name of that show?
Friends.
Tell Your Friends. That was the very first show that I hosted.
Really?
Yes. God.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, it's like 8 or 9 years ago.
Yeah, I don't think that bar exists anymore.
Wow. Good times.
So I got asked to do that show, and I went. Not Tell Your Friends, but it was another show one, but it was like a comedy show, and I was like, I'm not a comedian. And they were like, well, just do what you did at the other thing. And so then I got like booked on another stand-up show, and I was like very confused by that.
So do you remember the first thing you did at Lolita Bar? Mm-hmm, like, what'd you do? What'd you talk about?
I read this thing called Letters from My Mother, which was I had taken all these letters my mom had written me and strung them together in like one little thing. And I acted her out.
Okay.
While I did it. Cause she had said like the craziest shit to me when I moved to New York, like, you know, you should be, she was just like, she's a very sexual sexualized. She's a very, because she was so repressed in Southern Baptism, she was always pushing me to not be repressed.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Gotcha.
So I could just, I had a lot of good stuff to read.
So you did that and then you, like, how did that feel?
It felt great. I brought down the house and I was very excited. And at the same time, do you know Bushwick Star?
No.
It's a right around here. It's like a little independent theater. I think you would be really into it. I feel like you should check it out because they do local plays and they're the stuff that's coming out of there is like really high quality.
Is it kind of like a Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind? What's that place that's near? Never mind. But I get it.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
It's very cool.
Okay.
And so when I was working at Seven Stories Press and Washington Heights Free Radio, I would volunteer there at the Bushwick Star because I I was a little culture baby, you know?
Sure.
I was trying to absorb as much of New York as I could. And volunteering there, I got to work the bar and then keep all the tips and then see a play. So I was like, this is great. I'll do this. I did it like once a month. And then this is kind of an embarrassing story, but I'm going to tell it anyway.
Go for it.
So I did it one night and Reggie Watts performed.
Okay.
And this is around the same time that I had just done that Lolita reading.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up to me afterwards and he was just like, he's like reading my aura. For people who are listening to this, you can't see what I'm doing.
I could see him doing that.
But he put his like hands around me. He was looking at me and he was like, you're a performer. You're a performer. And I was like, no, I'm a writer. And he was.
And these are people telling you.
Yeah.
That you what you are.
And he was like, you're a performer. And then he just started listing all of these names. He was like, nope, you're a performer. Where do you perform? You perform at the UCB, the Magnet, the Pit. And I had never heard of those theaters. Mm-hmm. And I wrote them down. And then I was like, no, I don't. I'm a writer, you know.
Yeah.
And then I Googled them. And a New York Times article had just come out about the UCB. It was like a very fortuitous time situation. So I like found it, this article, and I was like, okay, fuck it, I'll take a class. And then I haven't looked back since.
You know, it's interesting. You kind of encapsulate what this podcast has kind of evolved into, because I've said this for the 4 years I've been doing it. New York, as brutal as it can be, as it is, it kind of shapes you into something.
Mm-hmm.
It molds you into, because when I moved here, I went straight through school. Like I went to grad school to become an actor, and I was doing that in Chicago. I was doing theater. I was living my dream. And then I moved here to like try to take it to the next level. And it was something that I was missing for like 2 years. Like I started comedy in 2009. And I was trying to find myself. I was doing like community theater and all this stuff in Jersey and trying to figure it out. Took a class at UCB. And I remember like when you do those, when you do the stuff, Herald, when you do the Herald, I did this little monologue about going to my class reunion and I got this laugh and I was like, wait a minute, this is something. And my dad had always told me, he's like, Chris, you should write. You need to write. You're a good writer. You should write. Remember this guy that passed away recently? We were doing theater. We were doing this heavy Hurricane Katrina themed play.
Oh.
And we were like, we were goofing around, singing and talking about stuff before the show to get loose. And he's like, Chris, you should be a comic. You should be a stand-up comedian. I was like, I'm afraid. I always loved stand-up, but I was afraid. Because somebody got booed on Showtime at the Apollo. It's like, I'm not doing that shit. I'm not doing that.
Cool.
Yeah. So I was just like, and to think about where I am now, it's just like, oh, and New York did that. Like, it kind of just like, you think you're coming here for one thing, but if you can tough it out, if you can persevere, it's going to tell you something. And it's like, even if you failed, you fucking did it. Like, you fucking tried. So that's kind of like goes like full circle to where we started out, like talking about family, saying, well, this guy left. And my mom told me that that super religious cousin was like, Chris is doing comedy, that comedy thing.
Oof.
Like judging.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, you never you never left. Like, you right. never, you were the smartest person, this probably the smartest, like, brain, probably the most gifted fucking brain on both sides of my family, and just like was stunted by something, like for fear. I could at least say, like, all the 10 years for, like, stuff starting to pay off, and we'll talk about it off mic, but it's just, like, sort of like, oh, well, it wasn't for nothing. Like, yeah. There's still, so that's awesome.
I could not agree more with what you're saying about New York changing you, and it's just, like, it is really, like, trial by fire, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like you come into New York, and it, like you said, it changes you in a way where you almost can't live anywhere else. Like, it sort of, it molds you into this person that you would not have become if you hadn't moved here.
Yeah.
And I don't want to, like, romanticize it, because it is really difficult.
It's tough. No,
it's
really
tough. But I am very, very happy that I moved to New York and I went through all these things, because, like I said, you know, I was just going to come here for a couple of years so that it looked good on my graduate school resume. And, you know, I would never have, I can't imagine the amount I have grown just from living in New York. It's fantastic.
Ashley Brooke Roberts, this was fucking great.
I had so much fun.
Plug your stuff. Tell people where they can find you and all that. I'll post links and stuff, but just tell everybody what you do.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Ashley B. Roberts. You can come to my Tumblr. It's Hello ABR. And I host a show every Thursday at the UCB East called Fresh Out at 9 p.m. And I'd love for you to come.
Ashley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right.